left over from last time. Specifically, we were trying to establish admissibility of the weakening rules, right? We were proceeding by induction over proofs, and we had discharged, I believe, one of the rules, which was the axiom rule, right? And maybe one additional one, the one of the negation rules, I think. So, anybody giving this further thought? You will have noticed that there's an exercise like this on the new sheet, right? So that's why I'm insisting so much.
Right, to regularize Right. Is everybody happy with this, in particular with the whole style of proof?
We have proof there on that one. We have proof that we have an actual hypothesis that we comply.
Well, no, I mean, that's the principle that we have an induction hypothesis.
Right? Okay, but so we need the beginning of the induction.
So, what was the beginning of the induction?
Yes.
Yes, indeed. Thank you. Right. So, I mean, the principle behind all this is that we regard proofs as a data structure and we do structural induction over this data structure. So, here we, I mean, basically we regard a new node in the proof tree, such as this one, as being composed of a rule application like this to another proof tree, or in the case of the AND WHITE rule, to two other proof trees. And basically, the induction principle is assuming that the proof trees right above our root satisfy our inductive claim, in this case, admissibility of a weakening root, show that the root itself also satisfies our claim. Slightly more naively, we just do induction over proof length, right? So this thing here has a properly shorter proof than this because it appears in the proof of this. So we can, the induction hypothesis saying for anything that has a shorter proof than our current goal, we can apply the induction hypothesis. All right, and the principle, of course, that you're asked to use in the proof of admissibility of the contraction rule, which is on the sheet, is exactly the same, right? So everything, I mean, you can almost copy it now, right? So, I mean, the structure of the proof is entirely the same. Right, so let's summarize the sheet again. So there's, I believe, one exercise in the beginning where you're asked to just prove some sequence in the system, of course, not semantically, but by providing a sequence style proof in using the rules that we've given. Then secondly, there's an exercise where you're asked to show that a proof search fails, and you're asked to do it in a special way because there's an additional question asking you what are the refuting evaluations that you get out of the failed proof search. And we want all refuting evaluations that there are. And there aren't so terribly many. I mean, quite precise, there are two. And we want to get them out of the proof search. That means we basically be as brute force as possible in the proof search. So even if you already know that the proof search fails because you have pursued one branch arriving to something that you must prove but that isn't provable, and thereby, of course, obtaining a refuting evaluation, you're nevertheless asked to do all the remaining branches in the proof tree because you need to find the other valuation, basically. Okay, then there's one thing about derivable rules. We haven't done an example of a derivable rule because, well, derivable rules are, well, we could do a derivable rule, actually. So let's do one derivable rule just to be on the safe side here. Something from double negation of phi, well, the other way around. So to show that we can conclude something from double negation of phi suffices to show that we can conclude it from phi. So, how does the derivation work? So, you'll try it. decide if you need more than two steps, then you've gone wrong somewhere. Important rule in all these fields is that telling usually doesn't tell. Right, thank you very much. Right, so this is a very easy example of a derivable rule. Notice the massive difference to the admissibility proof for the weakening rule, right? So we, in this case, we just take the premise of the rule, start a proof from there, and arrive at the conclusion. While no such thing is possible for the weakening rule, right? So if you look at the weakening rule again, you can try all you want to manipulate the premise using the proof rules, you will never arrive at the conclusion. Can somebody give a formal argument why that won't happen?
Something is with the Exim rule, which introduces something on both sides.
Right. This is about right, yeah. I had an even simpler argument in mind. I'm trying to think if my simpler argument was actually wrong. The argument that I have in mind is, if you look at the rules, there isn't a single rule that would decrease the number of formulas in the overall sequent. That would increase the number of formulas in the overall sequent. So, the only rule that changes the number of formulas in the sequent at all is the left conjunction rule, which does this. So you never get more formulas in the conclusion than you had. Well, this should be slightly obviously than you had in the premise. Of course, that isn't entirely true because there is one rule that massively increases the number of formulas, namely the Exim rule, which will just introduce a lot of formulas at once. I believe the argument is nevertheless correct. So what would it say? Okay, one has to be careful about what one means by this rule is not derived. Right, so what does that mean? So there, one way to read this, which would be wrong, would be to say whatever formulas I put in to fill up gamma and delta, this rule will never be derivable. That, of course, is wrong, because delta might contain phi. And as soon as delta contains phi, this here is an instance of the generalized axiom rule, so I just provide a proof of the conclusion, and then I'll have this instance proof. So what one means by the rule isn't derivable is, well, if I know nothing about the formulas in here, right, so if these are just, if gamma and delta are really just placeholders, then I can prove it. And then I believe the argument that I just gave should hold. Namely, if there was a proof, like this, right? If there was such a proof, basically I do induction over that proof. Now look what was the previous step here. Well, and basically what was the last rule applied? Because I said I don't know anything about gamma and delta, the last rule applied can't have been the axiom rule, because the axiom rule assumes that I know something about gamma and delta. So for instance, I could know that delta contains phi, then it works, but otherwise it doesn't. So if the previous rule wasn't the axiom rule, then there is some premise here. And that premise would also have to have been derived from here. And therefore, it would have had at most as many formulas. And then this doesn't work. Right? So that's a very rough sketch of a formal proof that the rule really isn't derived. Okay, so the point that I'm really trying to make here is, we've seen what a derivable rule is. And an admissible rule is something much weaker. So we're not able to provide a derivation of the conclusion from the premise. We just can prove whenever the premise is provable, then the conclusion is also provable by some possibly totally different proof. And actually, if one looks at what happens in the case of the weakening rule, so here's a rule. What happens is you look at a proof of gamma and tails delta, and you transform the whole proof by putting the phi basically everywhere. So you get a totally new proof. None of the new sequences agree with the old ones. Well, they look similar, of course, but none of them are identical because they all differ by having this additional phi. So that's the point about these admissibility proofs and the essential difference between admissibility and derivability. You cannot really say you've got a small piece of proof connecting the conclusion and the premise, but rather you have some method to transform proofs of one thing into proofs of another. Okay, let us do one more example. That's inversion. Conclusion. If the rule has several premises, then of course it's not quite that clear to say what it means to stand the rule on its head, because I have to say which of the which of the two premises become the conclusion. But actually, it turns out it doesn't matter which one I pick. So I'll just write the rules down. So here's the first one. That's the inversion of the bottom left rule, right? So notice the difference, right? The knot is now on top, while previously it was on the bottom. Same for the right rule. And same for the conjunction rules. So let's take the simple one first. That's the left one, where previously I basically introduced the conjunction sign on the left by joining the comma. And here I do the opposite, I just solve the conjunction sign. And then for the right rule, there are actually two inverted rules. One where I start with a conjunction phi and psi and just drop the right hand conjunct. And then, of course, the same thing but dropping the left hand conjunct. So these rules. So let us pick out one of them at random, say, which one's nice, maybe this one here. So let's give this one a name. So this is the inverse of the, well, the first inverse, I should say, of the conjunction right rule. So I have to assume that this here is provable. Also, by an induction over this derivation, that the induction takes a rather stupid form. The induction basically says, well, obviously this can only have been proved by the right rule for conjunction, except that needn't have happened in the last step. The conjunction here could have appeared some steps earlier. So I cannot say that, I mean, just seeing the sequence, it's guaranteed that the last rule would have been the right conjunction rule introducing this thing here. I don't know that. But of course, as soon as that happens, right, as soon as I establish that the right conjunction rule established this conjunction here, I have won, because that must have been from a premise that looked exactly like this. Well, what you do is some changes in Kalman delta, obviously. So I do an induction. Let's do the easy case first, right? So the easy case is that the last step was the one that we think it must be. Well, okay, then we're done, of course, right? So then, if that was the last step, then in particular, this left premise here must have been derivable, and we're done because that's what we want to show. Because that's the conclusion of our rule. Okay, case two. Case two is the last step was something else. Okay, now there's a large case distinction over all the rules. What is important is the last step must have concerned some other formula. So notice how all the rules basically concern as the primary target some... here's one example rule. So here, all of the rules concern one primary formula, it's called the principal formula in the conclusion. So here, for instance, this is the principal formula. And all the rules have an obvious principal formula. And so the principal formula in this case must have been something other than this. So that means the last step was of this form. There was some number of premises, well, I say k here, but of course the only possible values of k given our system are 1 and 2. Well, actually 0, 1, and 2. So, there were... make this clear to avoid confusion, right? So these aren't endlessly many premises, there can be at most 2 given our system. And from this we somehow... concluded this. Why? What is a good name for an arbitrary rule? I can't say r because that sounds. Well, let's take small r, right? So the last step was a rule small r. And the rule application looks like this. Basically, what happens is that my conjunction here just goes through the whole proof untouched because it just sits somewhere in the part that is named delta in the rules, which doesn't interest anybody, which is just carried on unchanged from sequence to sequence. And then, don't have enough room here, so I'll go up here. Okay, so now given this, all these premises have shorter proofs, so we can apply the induction hypothesis. So
So that means we can drop the second conjunct from all of them. So all these premises with the second conjunct I dropped are derivable by the induction hypothesis. They have shorter proofs, so I can apply the inversion, the inverted proof. And then I can apply the same rule R again. So R, like I said, doesn't care about what's here. This is just in the context somewhere. What actually happens, happens somewhere either in delta or in gamma. So this happens again. So this, by the same rule R, I can derive. This thing at the end. Let's do one simple example to see what the hell that means. So if the rule that I apply happens to be left conjunction, doesn't matter, then it looks like this. So in this case, the sequence at the bottom has this form here. I've got my conjunction sitting here on the right where it was before, and then I've got a not chi here. And this has been proved by the left conjunction rule by, well, basically shifting the chi to the right and dropping the negation. And of course, the phi and psi is still there. So this here is derivable. So by the induction hypothesis, the same sequence but with the and psi dropped is derivable. And then, like I said, by the same rule, in this case the left the left negation rule, I can do basically the same proof but with different chunks sitting on the right hand side here. So what I wanted to prove, right? And of course, they all look the same. So this is, unlike my whole side argument there, of course, dependent on a property of the proof system, namely that all the rules in the proof system have essentially the same shape. And we have to think of them as being turned upside down, of course, but the key property remains the same. They have some variable context, gamma and delta, on the right-hand side, which is just carrying on unchanged through the proof. The only thing that the rules do anything to are these principal formulas which are taken apart or shifted to the right or whatever, right? Okay. And of course the other inverted rules are proved to be admissible in exactly the same way. Okay. Now, we're going to stay on this track, induction over proofs, and then we're going to move away from the structural rules. Let me just remark, we've been a bit wholesale about the cut rule, right? So we've proved the admissibility of the cut rule some tactically. Basically, the argument is the cut rule is sound, therefore it's admissible. Remembering that admissible means it doesn't make any additional formulas provable, and if the system is sound and complete, that any sound rule is admissible. Of course, it cannot prove additional stuff because it can only prove valid formulas or valid sequence, and if the system is complete, then all valid sequence were already provable before that. But it is the whole point of the invention, or it was the whole point of the invention of these sequence systems by Gensim, to prove admissibility of the cut rule, not by the semantic argument, but syntactically. Right? We're skipping that here because it's too complicated. Right, so now for something completely different, well, not completely, but something that steers away from just the rule system. Well, I should use the board for your topic. Yeah.
interpolation. Okay, now I'm going to give a definition of what an interpolation is. I'm going to write the definition first and then we'll parse it, and then I'll explain what the hell this is about. The definition has two parts because I'm going to introduce two different forms of interpolation, different by strength. So, we start with two formulas where one is a logical consequence of the other. Have we introduced this notation here? I introduced it in going, but of course it should be called.
Not here.
So S of phi is the set of atoms that occur in phi. So this has a brief recursive definition, right? At the bottom is empty because no atom occurs in this formula, and I can see it, there's none, right? An atom does occur in this formula, namely the atom that I can see, so that's a singleton set. Well, atoms might occur in not phi, the not isn't one of them, so that's just the same as the atoms that occur in phi. And the conjunction phi m psi, then, well, any atom that occurs in this conjunction will be one that occurs in one of the conjuncts, so that's just the union of these two sets of atoms. So, and now I'm going to use this notion of atoms in a serious way, namely, phi entails psi, but phi and psi might not be talking about the same atoms. This happens. It sounds slightly counterintuitive, but for instance, recall that we have this thing, for instance, so the right-hand side uses more atoms than the left-hand side. Right? Or, here, for instance, is also a valid entailment, right? This here says B and not B. Well, of course, that's just an inconsistency. Logically entails the right-hand side. Talk about entirely disjoint sets of atoms. And the question is, can we somehow separate this? And the answer is yes. What this means is, in this case, there exists a formula chi such that two things seem zoned. So first of all, the chi talks only about those entities that both these formulas speak about. So that means the atoms in chi are only those that occur both in phi and in psi. So basically, chi talks only about the common language of phi and psi. And secondly, chi basically witnesses this entailment, that is, phi entails chi, and chi entails psi. Okay, so why is this important? Well, this is important because it tells us We can basically get away from logical entailments that talk about unrelated stuff. We can reduce them to logical entailments that talk about only about joint stuff. And so this isn't just arcane and academic. So for instance, I think since the late 90s or so, model checkers actually use this principle to reduce the search space. Because, I mean, knowing that you only have to talk about certain atoms reduces your search space. You know you only care about the three atoms that occur in phi and not about possibly 10 other atoms that occur in psi. Right? Okay, so that's one definition, and here's a stronger one. Let's say I have a formula, and I pick some of its atoms. And I want to basically extract what does the formula say about these atoms. My colleague Dirk Pattinson had this nice parable for this, or a nice motivation for this, when so this was at a workshop, which was, well, out of all things, on Barbados. He was basically referring to phi as all the knowledge about their trip to Barbados. And then you would be talking about this trip at home when you come back. So on the one hand, you would be talking to your friends and colleagues, and you would basically use vocabulary like beach and beer and the sun and whatever, which is going to be mentioned in the joint collected knowledge about the trip, that's in phi. And if you talk to your head of department, then talk about the reputation of the people that you met there and the joint papers that you started and the joint projects that you initiated and all that, right? So you extract knowledge about different domains from a given global knowledge. And again, reason does actually do that. So when you sit down, for instance, take an interface to a standard ontology reasoner like OTG, which will allow you to access ontologies. One of the reasoning services this thing is going to offer is going to be modularization of your ontology. You have a big, large ontology that contains more axioms and concepts than you'll ever care to read. My friend Snowman CT has something like, I think, 900,000 axioms talking about 300,000 different concepts or something like that. You don't want to read the whole thing. You want to know what knowledge does the ontology contain about heart disease or something like that, right? So you pick the vocabulary and you ask the reasoner to extract everything that the ontology or a knowledge base has to say about that vocabulary. Okay, how do we formalize this in this very simple setting of propositional logic? Well, I haven't said what term I'm defining here. Yeah, I'm defining what it means for chi to be an interpolant of phi and psi. And now I'm going to define something using only one formula. So I'm going to say phi psi is a uniform interpolant. Well, of what? First of all, it depends on phi, so I want to extract knowledge from phi. With respect to A. So, of course, again, there are two parameters, but in this case, one of them is only a set of atoms, not a whole formula. So, okay, so it's a uniform interpolant, blah, blah, if well, following three properties hold. First of all, at of psi is contained in A. So psi mentions only the prescribed atoms. It talks only about reputation papers and projects. Secondly, psi is actually integered by phi. So it is really something that follows from the knowledge base, if you will. And the third is, well, among all these formulas that have these properties, psi is the best one. That is, whenever I have a formula also talking only about the reduced vocabulary, and that formula is entailed by phi, then that formula is entailed already by psi. Okay, so basically psi is the best approximation of phi, the best upper approximation of phi that mentions only the restricted vocabulary.
So first you know that this is a definition, but in fact it's definition and lemma, right? Because you're already claiming that there exists such chi, which has...
Oh, that, of course this is wrongly formulated. Thanks for pointing that out. Somehow I've lost here in the formulation. I was wondering at the end why I hadn't defined anything. So of course, yes, I'm launching into the lemma immediately is the wrong thing to do. In particular, as we're not going to want to prove this right away, we want to look at this B thing first. Okay.
And maybe also it's worth mentioning that in classical logic one can define either proof existence of pre-interpolants or post-interpolants, and put that among the same thing, because here you just define one of them, but one could also...
Yeah, one could come from the other side, obviously. Yeah.
Yeah. And in other non-classical logic that we talk about, it won't be the same thing.
Yeah. So here, so what Adir is saying, that the fact that I'm only looking at upper approximations here doesn't really make a difference in classical logic, because I can just applications on both sides that turn the entanglement around, right? Which will not work in proper non-classical logic, so that's a property of classical logic. So I'm sticking to this formulation here, because it's not understand. Okay. So first of all, we should relate these two notions, right? So what does uniform interpolance have to do with interpolance? So let's take a uniform interpolant. So I take a uniform interpolant of psi with respect to a set A. And I want to show that it's an interpolant in a uniform way, that is, for all formulas that stick to the vocabulary. So sort of swapped. So then psi is an interpolant of formulas phi, comma, xi, and chi. Whenever first of all, chi follows from phi. And second, whenever the joint atoms of these two formulas are contained in A. So I hope that's right, because that's wrong in my notes. In these notes. Okay, let's prove it. Okay. So we have to show two things here. First of all, we have to show that this condition one here satisfied. Well, this is big, right? So the atoms of chi are contained in A, and therefore they're included in the intersection of the two vocabularies. So condition one from the definition is clear. Condition two. First of all, I have to show that chi actually follows from phi. Well, that's the case by definition of what a uniform interpolator is. So the hard part is the other bit. So basically, I have to take a valuation that satisfies chi.
Sorry?
Yeah.
Aren't those symbols messed up?
Aren't the symbols messed up?
We're trying to prove that.
I knew this was a bad idea. I was copying from the wrong place. Yeah. Just a moment. No, this should be psi. Right. But in the statement, it's still okay. Yeah. Okay. So now I have the slight problem that. Which of these things, the chi, may mention more atoms than just the ones in A. So I don't immediately get that this here, because this holds only for those chi that mention only atoms in A. Right? But I can just get rid of this. I've now formed a formula chi prime that I just form from chi by replacing the extra atoms with the truth values that cover two scribes. So it's a bit hard to write. This is kappa with some of the atoms substituted, namely substituted by the truth value kappa of A, which is just a perfectly good formula, true or false. For all those A that I don't want, that is, for all A that are not in my distinguished set A, all those I substitute away by the truth values that kappa prescribes.
Changing the notation between the two definitions was a little bit better. It just can't. So I just can't. Just
I know, I don't have to assume it's already up there. Right, so the next thing I have to show is that this modified formula chi prime is still a consequence of phi. So I have to assume, and my kappa is there, so which letters do I have left? Kappa prime. So, if I have an evaluation kappa prime that satisfies phi, I have to show that it satisfies chi prime. Well, by the assumption of the lemma, kappa prime will satisfy chi. Say that the things that are changed don't matter because they don't apply to phi. I don't know how to say this.
Well, if they were in phi, they would also have to be in A, right?
Yeah, so well, it's like if they're in chi and in phi, then they would also have to be in A, right? So that's so now I need to be able to.
Yeah, this must be obvious. Come on.
Okay, we need a third valuation of that. I need a third valuation, which I'm now going to call kappa double prime. So kappa double prime arises from kappa prime by renaming as prescribed by kappa. And I do this for all such a that are atoms in chi, but not in capital A. So here, of course, I should have done the same, right? Because only this matter for chi, so these are the ones that are in atoms of chi minus A. Okay. So this here is a relevant that was confusing, true but confusing. So now I've changed atoms that are in atoms of chi but not in A, and these are not in phi. Right? Because if they were in phi and in atoms of chi, then they would have to be in A. So all these things I'm changing are not mentioned in phi. So this here implies A is not an atom in phi. So if I'm changing only atoms that don't appear in phi, then nothing changes about satisfaction of phi, right? So kappa double prime still satisfies phi because I'm changing only atoms that don't occur in phi. Now, kappa double prime satisfies chi. Okay, now looking again at what I've done here, I changed kappa prime to kappa double prime by mapping the atoms and at chi minus A to kappa of A. Well, here I've instead changed the formula, right? I changed all the atoms that are in atoms of chi but not in A to their truth value under kappa. So once I've changed the evaluation, and once I'm changing the formula, I change them both in the same way, namely by setting atoms to the evaluation under kappa. So this implies that kappa prime satisfies chi prime, right? Oof. And that's what we wanted to show. So now finally this is over, right? So we did show that chi prime is a consequence of chi. So, now we've shown that chi prime is a consequence of phi. Moreover, the atoms of chi prime are contained in A because all the ones that aren't have been substituted away by the truth values under kappa. So, that is because psi was a uniform turbulent of phi with respect to A. it follows that chi prime is a consequence of psi. Because that's the definition of a uniform token. That's clause 3, right? Okay, and now we're almost done. Where are we? We still need to show that. Okay, we still need to show that this cut idea that we've been given originally that this satisfies chi. Okay. So my assumption, let's repeat this, the original assumption was that kappa satisfied psi. Well, from that and this logical consequence here, right, it follows that kappa satisfies chi prime. And then it follows that kappa satisfies also the original chi, because these two only differ by replacing some atoms with truth values that kappa gives them anyway. Okay, oops, so that went halfway smoothly after this glitch in between. Okay, so now we have this relationship between uniform interpolation and interpolation. Somehow this shouldn't have been so hard, but it seemed non-trivial from the way it was.
For those who have seen something involving quantifiers, for example, Lorini could also mention the analogy between the rules defining the clauses defining uniform interpolant and the quantifier clauses.
Yeah, not sure it's useful, but yes.
Okay, maybe.
I think the analogy would be sort of hard to spot. Okay, so it's going to appear anyway. So now now we've defined what this is, and we've seen that there are two properties, and that, well, as logics vary, some will have interpolance and some will have uniform interpolance. We've seen that having uniform interpolance is stronger than having interpolance, and there are examples showing that it's properly stronger. In particular, in modal logic, uniform interpolation is comparatively rare, while interpolation is slightly more common. But in propositional logic, in effect, we have a stronger form. Yeah, so we'll show that we have uniform interpolance. And we're going to show it in three different ways. And I'm going to start at the most semantic one and proceed to the syntactic. So here's another nice quote. This one goes back to Bernhard Reuss, actually. If you like long inductions over syntax, then you don't need semantics. So we're going to start with a cheap way, doing it semantically, and proceed to the expensive way. And on top of that, the expensive way is going to give us less. It's going to prove only interpolation rather than uniform interpolation. But it's going to do it in a way that we can reuse later for other logics. So we're going to do it anyway. So here's a very short proof. Let's write this short for classical propositional logic, CPL. Writing has uniform interpolation, what I mean by that is for every formula and every set of names, there is a uniform interpolation. Given two formulas, given the formula phi in the set A of atoms, put. And I'm just going to write down the uniform term. This is the preferred name of the uniform turbulence. Sorry.
Okay, psi is going to be a, well, big conjunction, but big will mean finite. Of a set of formulas, which better be finite. So let this range over, well, all propositional formulas, but only those in conjunctive normal forms to, well, make clear that what I'm getting here is finite. And taking those chi, whose atoms are contained in A, so those conjunctive normal forms that mention only the prescribed atoms, and that follow logically from psi. Okay. And the proof ends there. Well, why does it end there? Well, because it's blatantly obvious that this is a uniform interpolant. Right, so what do we have to check? Well, first of all, we have to check that this thing is a formula, so there is one more remark here. These conditions here, having all conjunctive normal forms and limiting the number of atoms that they can use, says that these are, well, essentially finitely many, essentially meaning I don't, I do the same thing as we did in Gloin. We look at a conjunctive normal form as being a set of clauses and a clause as being a set of literals. So of course, if I allow repeating the same literal 20 times in a row or more, then I'm still going to get infinitely many conjunctive normal forms, but I want to read these things modulo, reordering the clauses and literals, and modulo removing duplicates, and then there's only finitely many conjunctive normal forms, namely, first of all, how many clauses are there that I can form given a prescribed finite set of atoms? Well, I can go through the atoms and for each atom decree to either use, well, I can be generous actually, to either use it positively or negatively or both or not at all. Okay, using them both, of course, is an entirely sensible sort choice, and I could just as well exclude that, but since I only want to prove it's finite, so let's assume there are four possibilities, one of which is points. Okay, so four possibilities for each atom, so there's however many atoms there are in eight clauses. That's the maximum number of clauses I have. And then for each clause, I can decide whether or not to include it in my conjunctive normal form. So that's 2 to that number properly different CNFs. Rough upper estimate. So there's only finitely many of these, so this is actually a formula. And then the rest is clear, right? So what do I have to show of this thing? I have to show, firstly, that it mentions only the atoms in A. Well, it's a conjunction of conjunctive normal forms that all mention only the letters in A. And then we have to show that it actually follows from psi. But, well, it's a conjunction of things that follow from psi, so better than well follow from psi. And I have to show that it's stronger than anything that meets these conditions, so any stronger than any chi that mentions only atoms in A and is logically entailed by phi. Well, all these chi appear in this big conjunction here. Well, their CNFs do. And, well, of course, the conjunction is stronger than all its conjugates. So that's it, right? So it's just immediate to write down this form. Well, okay, the reason that we can do this is, of course, that we have a simple normal form result for propositional logic saying that if we only have finite syntactic material, that is, only finitely many atoms, then we can form only finitely many pairwise and equivalent formulas. So that's a trick that we're not going to be able to pull again anytime soon. That is not a property that logics usually have. So, next attempt.
Well, I'm right to big order. So we've proved uniform interpolation. We want to do it in a slightly more cunning way. I mean, in particular, this here is horrible, right? So this thing here has up to doubly exponentially many conjuncts, each of which has up to exponential size. Well, okay, the second remark is actually irrelevant, right? Doubly exponential times exponential isn't really worse than doubly exponential. So exponential times exponential stays exponential, and doubly exponential times exponential is still exponential. But so this is quite a horrible form. It remains horrible, but maybe not quite that horrible. Let's say we have an atom. Then we can decide to introduce a quantifier over that atom. We write exists A. So we write exists A dot phi. So we abuse the atom as a variable, as it were. Right? So we look at the atom as something for which we can substitute things from the semantic domain. Well, the semantic domain, as we've looked at it so far, isn't terribly large. It has two values, false and true. So, well, this here means there exists some truth value that we can put in for A such that phi holds. Well, let's just take the two. So first, we can take true and syntactically substitute it for A in the formula. That's the one chance we have to make this true. Or we take false, autumn. Okay, so that's apparently a sensible definition. This here isn't even something that we specifically invent for the proof. This here is called the quantifying Boolean formula. This translation here shows that anything we can express in quantified Boolean logic, we can also express in basic Boolean logic. But that's something we don't even have to show, because we know we can represent any old Boolean function in basic Boolean logic and propositional logic, because we know that propositional logic is functionally complete, is the word. Right? So basically, if we write down any sort of truth table, we'll be immediately able to come up with a formula that describes exactly that truth table. But we see here that the phi is copied. One copy of phi is here, one copy of phi is there. Well, slightly changed, of course, but still a copy. So if we do carry out this translation, we get exponential lower. And that's also something we will not be able to get away from. So then, if we're again given these data, phi and a, so we want to establish that these two, I mean, the phi has a uniform complement with respect to A. Well, let's define a formula. Okay, now, of course, what we're going to do is just quantify out all the atoms that we don't want. Now, of course, that works syntactically only if we know which atoms we don't want. So let's give them names. So we take the atoms of phi and take away the atoms of A and say these are atoms A1 up to AK. And now we quantify out these unwanted atoms. So we have k quantifiers, exists A1, exists AK, applied to phi. And we claim that this formula is a uniform interpolant of phi with respect to A. Now, that is a more sensible way of producing this. In particular, this is a way of doing it that has a hope of being applicable in other logics. And in fact, recent proofs of interpolation in various modal logics
use variants of that method. Of course, variants that are nowhere as easy as the one I've just defined in particular will not be possible to write this one-line definition of this quantifier. But the principle remains the same. To form a uniform interpolant, just quantify out the unwanted syntactic material. So, okay, so this of course is something we have to prove. Well, we have to prove three things. First of all, this thing mentions only the atoms that it's allowed to mention, only those in A. Well, I'm claiming that it's clear. Why is that clear? Well, whenever we form such a quantifier, we eliminate, by expanding that abbreviation there, the atom that is quantified. We replace it by either top or bottom everywhere, so it's no longer there. So, next. We have to show that this thing actually follows from phi. So this the fastest way to do that is to show something general, namely that by applying a quantifier, I generally weaken the formula. So I'm claiming that generally phi logically entails exists a dot phi. And once I've done that, then clearly, I mean, by applying this principle k times in a row, I will have established that psi here is a logical consequence of phi. Well, to see this, let's assume that kappa satisfies phi. We have to show that kappa satisfies also the right-hand side. Well, kappa certainly satisfies the formula phi if I actually replace the atom A with the truth value that it gets under kappa. I, strictly speaking, that's something that would have to prove by induction over phi, but it should be clear, right? I just the truth value assigned to A, then I can just as well replace A with that truth value. Well, but then, of course, kappa satisfies this existential formula, because, I mean, this is either true or false, right, and depending on what it is, it's going to be equal to one of those disjuncts up there that define exists A dot phi. Okay, that's the second part. And for the third part, let's take the data that appears there. So let's take the formula chi, whose atoms are contained in A, and which follows from phi. So recall what we have to show. To show that psi entails chi. And again, I'm going to show something something general from this, from which this is clear. So what I'm going to show is if I have a logical entailment and I have an atom not appearing on the right-hand side in the chi, then I can introduce this existential quantifier here. The chi also follows from the existentially quantified formula. So applying this principle k times here, right, I can introduce the k quantifiers that I add to phi to the same psi. Right? So this general principle implies my claim here. And in this case, yes, it is worth pointing out that this is exactly like the quantifier introduction rule for, sorry, not introduction, the quantifier elimination rule for the existential that we looked at in Gloy. Right? So if the conclusion of a proof does not mention stuff that appears here in the assumptions, then I can existentially quantify the assumptions. Okay, so proof of that. Assume that some valuation kappa satisfies this existential this existentially quantified formula. Well, this is a disjunction of two things, and of course the two sides are totally symmetric, so I can just assume it's one of them. So let's say it's the one for bottom, so it's a kappa which satisfies phi and bottom substituted for A. Then I do the same trick, I transfer the bottom from the formula into kappa, so I map A to bottom in kappa. This will satisfy phi. Then, by my assumption up there, this implies that kappa satisfies chi, and okay.
Isn't there a step in between? So I can, the assumption gives me that kappa with A substitution.
Ah, sorry, there's one missing yet. So this here, so, yeah, and actually it's an important step. So this, the assumption gives me that this thing here, the changed valuation, satisfies chi, and now I apply that A doesn't chi doesn't mention A. So I can freely change it. For instance, I can just change it back to its original value, which part I cover, which will still satisfy chi. So the value of A doesn't matter. Thank you. So now it's right, so yeah, that's the more semantic ways of going about these interpolation proofs. And tomorrow we're going to look at a proof theoretic one. So we're going to establish interpolation, only interpolation, not uniform interpolation, by doing induction on proofs. Okay, are there any questions right now about the sheet? Of course you can still ask them tomorrow, but feel free to ask them now. Okay, so in that sense, see you tomorrow.